It's time for Gervais Law, the intersection of law and life with your host, Alan Gervais. Alan is the managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervais & Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm which has represented injured workers for over 35 years. And now, here's your host, Alan Gervais.
Good evening. I am Alan Gervais, the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervais & Wynn. And this is Gervais Law. I am flying solo today. It's been a while that I haven't had a guest co-host, but I think I can do it. I'm up to the challenge, and I have two spectacular attorneys who will be joining me today. So if I can handle it, I know they can, because both of them have been at the forefront in their respective legal specialty. Two of the best attorneys in the country. Later in the show, we welcome Marilyn Chinitz, who is a divorce attorney, high net worth cases. Such clients include Tom Cruise, Michael Douglas, Wendy Williams. She's working on a book, How to Stay Married. Imagine that, a divorce attorney working on a book, How to Stay Married. So she has a lot of insight into family matters. But before we get to family matters, let's talk a little bit about sports matters, because to me, sports does matter. Our first guest today is one of the preeminent antitrust sports law trial attorneys in the country. He has served as a lead counsel on so many complex antitrust sports and intellectual property litigation in the country. He's a partner at Winston & Strawn, one of the preeminent firms in the world. Law 360 recently named his practice as a practice group of the year. He serves as the co-executive chairman and co-chair of the firm's antitrust competition and sports law practices. And he's a lecturer in law at Columbia Law School, where he's taught a course on complex litigation. Some of his major sports and entertainment clients have included the National Football League Players Association, National Basketball Players Association, William Morris Endeavor, Major League Baseball Players Association. We're going to have to ask Jeff about the recent lockout that ended, and we've got baseball back, should be starting right about now, coming up soon. And, of course, the United States Women's National Soccer Team. And we have a lot to talk about the U.S. Women's National Soccer Team. Jeff Kessler, welcome to Gervais Law.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
You got a lot of applause. Apparently, people want to hear about these subjects. And I know you have been busy. You have a long history of complex litigation. And I'll tell you, when we say complex, it really is, because let's first talk about the women's soccer team and their lawsuit. The settlement took place on February 22nd for $24 million. It was scheduled to be heard the 9th U.S. Circuit Court right here in Southern California in Pasadena. And the issues included the U.S. Soccer Federation's actions purportedly violating Equal Pay Act and the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. A lot of people, Jeff, wanted to see this trial go forward, but it didn't. Tell us a little bit about the case and why people are disappointed. Some of them, I know it's not the national team, they're happy with the settlement, but why was it important for the public to hear about these issues?
Thank you. So this is a case by the world champion women on our national team, two times winners in a row of the World Cup, and really the greatest women's soccer team in the world. And they brought this case because they were paid at a lower rate than the men's national soccer team, even though they do the same job. And frankly, they are much more successful than the men.
Right.
And they have the same employer, which is the United States Soccer Federation. So we viewed this as a violation of the Equal Pay Act and also of Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, which also applies to gender discrimination in the workplace. And the case pursued claims of both unequal pay and unequal working conditions. Recently, as you pointed out, at the eve of an appellate hearing, we were able to settle this case for the women with fantastic terms from their standpoint. The most important term is that United States Soccer, for the first time in its history, has agreed that the women will receive an equal rate of pay going forward. And that really was the principle, the point of the case. The women felt that they had a duty to stand up for women everywhere, because if the world champion soccer players could not get equal pay, then who could?
That's a good, you know, that Jeff, that's a good question. But let me just go back real quickly to what you just said. How do you guarantee that moving forward there's going to be equal pay? Because a lot of people would be cynical about certain kind of agreements, and especially when, you know, you've had so much experience with the players' associations in professional sports. How do you put it on paper in a settlement that that's going to take place?
So we defined what it meant in this settlement. We defined that it meant that you get the same rate of pay. So that means if you win a World Cup and the men get a bonus, you would get the same bonus if you won the World Cup. If you play in what's called a friendly game, you would get no less than the same appearance fees and bonuses as the men get for winning friendly games. So we defined what that would mean. And it's embodied in what's a class action settlement, so it will be binding. And we also, in the process of completing a collective bargaining agreement, because there's a union in this sport, and that new collective bargaining agreement will embody this equal pay principle.
Now, is it based on the success, performance of the athletes, or gender equality?
So it's based on gender equality. The principle is, if the women play the same number of games as the men and are at least as successful as the men, then they should make no less.
Right.
In fact, if the women are more successful than the men and there's a bonus structure, then they should make more. Right. Think of two salespeople. If you had a male salesperson and a female salesperson, and they got a commission of 20% for the man and 10% for the women, right? That would be discrimination.
Yes, it would.
If they both had a 20% commission, that would be equal pay, and whoever got more sales would get more money. No one has any problem with that.
Exactly.
In terms of that. And in fact, the women would get more money probably because they are more successful, at least right now.
Right.
So that was the concept going forward. And the $24 million is for damages in the past.
Now, is there a clause in there that does guarantee that based on performance and based on the things that you're talking about, that the women will get more money than the men? Because when we think about it, some of the women soccer players are much more well-known in this country. Legends like Alex Morgan and Megan Rapinoe and Hope Solo, those are almost household names, or at least for people who follow, whereas a lot of people would be hard-pressed to name male soccer players in this country.
Yes, that's 100% correct. And the idea would be that if the they're compensated for could be done in a variety of ways. It could be you get a salary per game. You could have a bonus structure for winning the game or having a draw, or, you know, as opposed to losing the game.
Yeah.
You could have a bonus for making the World Cup. You could have a bonus for winning the World Cup. The idea would be it's got to be equal rates. So if they perform better, then they will get paid better, right? If they perform the same, it should be the same. That's what everyone should be striving for in this country.
Exactly. And, you know, I think the elephant in the room here is the money interests. Clearly, it's not about male or female necessarily, but it's about, like you say, equal performance. And if women are bringing in more money and are more popular, then it would suggest that they should be paid accordingly, just like we see, for instance, in the NCAA tournament, basketball tournament. Let me ask you this. Do you argue that the women should have the same notoriety on the women's side than the men's side? Should they get the same media attention that the men do?
So that's not really a part of an equal pay case.
No, it isn't.
One would hope that they would get that just by virtue of their performance. And in fact, it's true. As you said, you know, more fans, even casual fans, are likely to know names of the women players and follow them than they are right now the male players, just because of their comparative success. If you look at their social media numbers, the women have higher social media numbers than do the men on their team. So, you know, I think that follows naturally. We don't have to sort of legislate that. Where the law comes in, and because this is a problem really not at all directed just at women soccer players, this is a problem for women in this country and globally, there is a pervasive amount of gender discrimination. Right. Where women performing the same job as men do not get paid as well.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. I want to pick this up after the break. We got to go to break. We're talking to Jeffrey Kessler, and this is Gervie's Law. We'll be right back. I'm Alan Gervie. This is Gervie's Law and Talk Radio, 790 KBC. We're talking to Jeffrey Kessler, attorney with Winston & Strawn. And before the break, we were talking about the settlement of the women's soccer litigation, $24 million. Jeff, I had read somewhere that, I'm not going to say you were seeking, because as an attorney, I don't like to say I am seeking, but there was a demand for $66 million initially. Then we have a settlement of $24 million, which by all indications, the women who were plaintiffs here were happy about. Tell us a little bit about the numbers and how you, as an expert in antitrust litigation and sports law, come up with these numbers.
So the 60 plus million was the amount of damages that our expert calculated that would have been presented at if we went to trial. And that was based on an assessment of what would the women have made over a five-year period had they played under the men's agreement.
I see.
And that difference was more than $60 million. The reason the women were happy to accept less, well, I wouldn't say they were happy. They were willing to accept less.
Right.
They were happy with the settlement, is that they were in this first and foremost for the equal pay principle going forward, to set this precedent for future generations of women and girls, and for other women in the workplace. They were never in this just for their own damages, so they were willing to compromise on the damage amount. And as you know, since I know you've done many cases, when you do a settlement, it's going to be a compromise
right.
number. You know, if you want the full number, then you have to go to trial. And they felt, rather than keep going, we had to get to an appeal. We then had to get back to a trial. It would take years more to try to win this. That if they could get an equal pay commitment going forward, then they agreed that $24 million would be sufficient damages for the class to make this a very positive settlement.
And again, you have to include some intangibles like continuing to deal with ongoing litigation against their employer, how that weighs on you mentally. And I know as an attorney who has represented so many, not only athletes, but companies and individuals, that's something that you talk about with your client, because it's the reality that they're playing this game, or they did play this game, and they don't want the mental stress moving forward.
That's right. That's clearly a factor here. I would say there was also the concept that if they could resolve this, they could direct their attention to working with USSF to build the sports. Right? Because in the end of the day, players and teams have to work together in order to promote their sport.
How do you see this impacting future generations of women in sports and sports in general?
So I think inspirationally, it's very important. You know, I think, you know, I've seen, you know, so many young girls, you know, 10 to 14 years old, how they have followed this case. I don't know if they've ever followed the case before and idolize these women and, you know, and have learned about the equal pay principle. By the way, I've seen little boys as well learn this lesson. And I think as a matter of principle and inspiration, it's very, very important. In terms of legal precedent, I also think there's an important legal principle here that you can't discriminate on rate of pay, which is one of the issues that we had in our case. You know, how it will play itself out, you know, through the courts and cases in the future, we'll have to see. But I certainly think this was an important milestone in the equal pay movement.
Clearly it was. There are so many consequences that are positive moving forward. But you mentioned about girls or boys growing up looking forward to playing sports. And let's just take, for example, girls who put in a lot of time and effort. I have two kids, 8 and 9 years old. I can't believe how much time my daughter puts into softball at 8 years old and my son into hockey and baseball at 9 years old. And then you get to college and you find out, at least if you go to my alma mater, Brown University, you find out that all of a sudden there are sports that are being eliminated from their program. Now, you were right in the middle of the lawsuit that was filed, and it was part of Sports Illustrated feature article in June of 2020. Tell us a little bit about what happened at Brown and what the current situation is with those sports that were just mysteriously, after a year of hush-hush, nothing, taken away.
Well, so this wasn't just Brown. There were a number of schools who, you know, suddenly decided that they were going to cut a number of their varsity sports. And this obviously is devastating to the athletes involved who choose their schools in part on being able to play on those teams.
Right.
And the legal issues that come up are twofold. One is, in many cases, the schools deceptively hide their plan to cut the sports from the athletes and their families, and basically induce them to come to the school thinking the sports will be there, and then they're not.
Sounds like breach of contract to me.
Yeah, breach of contract, misrepresentation.
Right.
It raises all sorts of issues of that type. Then there also are frequently gender discrimination issues. If the way you're doing, or sometimes racial discrimination issues, if the way in which you're cutting the sports has that impact. And this plays out differently in different schools. In Brown, the case that actually led to restoring many of these teams was a gender discrimination case that had already been filed before I ever became involved with the issue. And ultimately led to a settlement where, for gender discrimination under what's called Title IX,
right,
many of the teams had to be restored. I had a similar dispute in Stanford, which was really incredible because Stanford said they had to suddenly cut, I think it was 8 or 9 teams to save a few million dollars a year when Stanford's endowment is, you know, billions and billions of dollars. It was just absurd what they did there. And we filed a lawsuit there for fraudulently deceiving the athletes and their families. And a week after we filed, Stanford restored all the teams.
Why did they do that? Are they in fear of perhaps individual lawsuits or the bad publicity? There's got to be a reason.
They did not want revealed in discovery how they had hidden this from the athletes and their parents.
Do you believe? Go ahead.
And you know, and I was going to say, because you're a hockey parent, we had a case like this or a dispute at Robert Morris University in Pittsburgh for cutting their men's and women's hockey teams, and those have now been restored.
It's really incredible because it's really amazing work that you're doing when you're working on this case. You talk about lawyers who have rewarding jobs. You are contributing to so many kids and young adults' success and happiness by being able to restore these programs. As you know, it can mean the world to, you know, and I know at Brown, I know student athletes when I was there, and I can't imagine them having their sports taken away from them. So, you know, I know you put in a lot of time and effort into this. How rewarding is it, these kind of victories?
So they are very personally rewarding. You know, in the case of Stanford, there was a social media explosion of the athletes celebrating with their friends when the teams were restored. So just seeing that, was very, very satisfying. Another case I've been involved with this past year was we went to the Supreme Court in a case called Alston versus the NCAA, which was on behalf of the college athletes against all the NCAA restrictions that prevent them from being compensated.
Right.
And as a result of that case, we've seen an explosion of opportunities for athletes this year. And so many of them are impoverished. So many of them, these are life-changing differences in being able to earn this additional money while they're in school. So, yes, it's incredibly satisfying on a personal level.
And it's well-deserved as well. We only have a couple minutes left talking to Jeffrey Kessler. Let me ask you your opinion on what damage has been done with the Major League Baseball lockout and then, of course, the resolution.
Oh, so I don't think there's been any damage.
Well, that was the right answer. That's the right answer.
It's one, that was not a game that was lost. And I don't think, frankly, fans or the public pay all that much attention to the back and forth negotiating. They care if they miss their game.
You mean you're not the most important person in their lives?
And so I don't think it's going to have any fan impact. And even if there had been missed games, you know, history shows that when the sports do come back, I mean, I've gone through, you know, lockouts in basketball, the NBA.
You're right.
You know, I've gone through them in football, in the NFL. And so, you know, generally speaking, you know, the fans love their sports. They're going to be there. And one thing that's important to keep in mind, in all of these recent cases, like in baseball, it was the owners locking out the players.
Yeah.
Players are ready to play. And you know, so it was the owners who shut down their own business in order to try to get leverage against the players in the bargaining. And so, you know, one would hope if there had been missed games, if the fans were going to be angry at anyone, it would be the owners, not the players.
You know, I'm glad you said that.
Because the players here, you know, would have played from day one.
Exactly. And I'm glad you said that, Jeff, because too many times we hear in the media about the impact of this on the fans and they're never coming back. And it takes a lawyer who does this for a living to explain that this is just business, and it's not going to impact the sport. If there's a problem with the sport, it's not through these kind of negotiations other than people taking sides. We only have a minute left, Jeff. Tell us what's on the horizon for you. What are you working on now?
Well, I've always got something going on. You know, I've got an interesting case for elite swimmers against an organization called FINA, which is the international body that regulates swimming, that's trying to suppress a competing swimming league, international swimming league, from developing. So I've got that going on. I've got another case against the NCAA called House that is seeking to get damages for the players over the past 4 or 5 years for not being able to exploit their names, images, and likenesses. And I've got a very interesting pro bono case involving gender discrimination, involving the winter sports at the Olympics.
Wow.
That's before the Court of Arbitration of Sports. So there's always something going on here.
Jeff, we're going to need to have you come back on to talk about those cases. They sound fascinating. Thanks for being with us today on Gervie's Law. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Take care. All right. We're going to go to a quick break. After the break, Marilyn Shinetz. And you're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
You're listening to Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life on AM 790 KABC.
Yes, you are listening to Gervie's Law, and I'm Alan Gervie. What a show. I think I should call the show Hall of Fame. Don't have a co-host here today. I'm flying solo, but I think Jeffrey Kessler in the first half hour really took care of business, talking about his expertise in sports law and antitrust law, talking about the women's soccer team, the Brown University, gender discrimination in sports teams, and a host of other interesting sports issues, including the Major League Baseball lockout. Now we're going to change. We're gonna do a little change here into family law, because we go from sports law to family law, and we're going to welcome one of the top 50 women lawyers in New York, as stated by Super Lawyers. She's a partner in the Matrimonial and Family Group of Blank Rome. She focuses on family matters involving divorce, custody, international abduction cases, prenups, postnups. She was honored as a champion for change by the Weinberg Center for Elder Justice. She focuses her practice on high net worth cases, divorces, including people like Tom Cruise, Michael Douglas, Wendy Williams. She does a heck of a lot of philanthropic work involving the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation of America, Foundation of Gender Equality, and Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation. And she's even writing a book on how to stay married. Imagine that, a divorce attorney writing a book on how to stay married. Marilyn Shinetz, welcome to Gervie's Law.
Thank you.
You're nice getting a standing ovation. You can't even see it.
No, but I'm hearing it. I'm loving it. I thought it was to the sports team.
Yeah, exactly. No, you know, it's funny because last time I had Alan Dershowitz on the show, I had this long introduction, and he said to me, you know what? I need to tape that and play it every morning when I wake up to motivate myself to get going. But well, I don't think
that's
you.
When you have a big ego, I don't think I need that.
You don't need that. You do things for the right reasons, because I've seen. In fact, I watched you on the Dr. Drew podcast recently, and Dr. Drew was just on our show a couple months ago talking about his book. It Doesn't Have to Be Awkward, that he wrote with Paulina Pinsky. And on Dr. Drew podcast, you really came across as a human being, someone, you know, you talked about your past growing up as a child of Holocaust survivors, dealing with your former partner and best friend, Geraldine Ferraro. And the humanity really comes out. And sometimes in divorce attorneys, the public doesn't see it.
Yeah, I think it's really important, because it's the way your clients connect with you. And they have to know that you're real, that you feel what they're feeling, that you understand what they're going through. And you can't fake that. It's just either you have it or you don't have it. So I think that level of passion is really required, especially when you're doing matrimonial. But more particularly, just as an attorney representing people, you have to let them know that you understand what's going on.
What are you most proud of when you think about that? Because those are such important values. But I know you've had a long, illustrious career. As you sit here now, what do you think of, wow, I'm really proud about that?
You know, I have to say quite a few things. I have the greatest experience with clients. And when their divorce cases are concluded, for many years thereafter, we have stayed friends. And every year, and it's coming up soon, in April, I host a big lunch for women. Although my practice is probably 70% men, this luncheon for women is a great opportunity for former clients, current clients, to network and meet each other, because they have so much to offer one another. And that's a proud thing for me to see all these people getting together. And they do have a common thread. They all went through, or they're going through, a divorce. But I also am very proud of the hard work over a period of 40 years. And that hard work resulted in some great decisions over the years, a lot of creativity, and even the uncovering of a murder that took place in December 2019. So those are very proud moments for me. And they all come from the desire to get a great result for a client.
You know,
I feel good about that.
It's such a fascinating story. And you've had a lot of, can I say, maybe bizarre cases. But you know, you mentioned uncovering a murder, and the facts of that are so interesting, especially given the fact that you weren't even representing the woman at the time. Is that correct?
Yeah, I did not even know the woman. She was going through a divorce. I had no idea who she was, what her story was. Her family came to me after she had been buried. And the reason why they came to me is they wanted to make sure that they got to spend some time with their sister and sister-in-law, the children. And they were sitting shiva, which means in the Jewish religion, they were grieving for a period of time when family and friends come and they really celebrate the person who died. But the children were not coming to see the grandparents and the aunts and uncles. So they came, the brother came to me and said, I would like to start a court proceeding and get the children to come and pay their respects, and we want to spend time with them. And I spent hours with the family, and I said, look, if you're going to retain me, you're going to have to hire private investigators that I want to get involved so that they could really look at what the police didn't see. And that was whatever circumstantial evidence was out there.
Wait a second, Marilyn. You are known as the divorce attorney, and it seems to me that you were getting into an area that maybe you weren't as familiar with.
I knew nothing about. You're right. But, you know, but I did, because I knew that in New York, you can't petition to have custody or access to grandchildren unless you have what we call standing, right? You understand standing.
Yeah.
And so I knew that in this case, if I was going to get access for the grandparents, for the family, I had to really understand what the facts were. So you're right. I did not know what I was getting into. But what I did know was that the police were too quick to make a decision to bury this woman without an autopsy, and too quick to make a decision that it was an accident, that she had fallen in the bathtub, hit her head, and died. But without looking into the underlying facts, she was in the middle of a divorce case. There was an order of protection. She had gotten exclusive occupancy, and there were false allegations made against her.
There's another fact.
In the background.
There's sure. another fact that we need to talk about here. The family was Orthodox Jewish, and there's an issue about autopsies, and also with respect to your expertise with divorces, the halacha or the Jewish law was a little bit different than what you deal with under New York law.
Correct. So that was a big challenge. But even though the family was Orthodox and they don't believe in having an autopsy, it was incumbent upon the police to say, we are suspicious of this and we are mandating that an autopsy take place. That should have happened, and it didn't. What happened instead was even more horrific, which was that a Jewish organization was called with very good intentions, but they came to the apartment where the deceased was, and they cleaned out the bathtub filled with water, and they scrubbed her fingernails and her skin in preparation for burial. And in so doing, they wiped out all of the evidence that would have been on her body.
Wow.
Not that their intentions were bad, but because the police said it was an accident,
yep.
they properly prepared her for burial. So it made the case even more challenging for a whole host of reasons.
And, of course, the result was?
The result was that after 10 years, he was convicted and sentenced to 25 to life. And why did it take 10 years? Because without direct evidence, it was really hard to convict him. He got convicted. Well, he got indicted. Let's back up. He got indicted because his then girlfriend was badly beaten by him. She went to the police station and she reported that he beat the crap out of her. And by the way, he told me he murdered his wife.
Wow.
And then the district attorney was able to do things more directly. And it's a fascinating transcript. The criminal trial, I have to really say that the prosecutor was outstanding and took a case that was very challenging and brought about a conviction. So that
amazing.
Was, and thank God there was a conviction.
Thank goodness.
Because my husband said,
yes.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick break. We want to talk more to Marilyn Chinitz after the break. We're going to talk about her quote, in every single long-term marriage, you might have wanted to pull the trigger, but didn't do it. Stay married? From a divorce attorney? Stay tuned. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
Need some legal, moral, or just common sense advice from a friend? Call Alan Gerby at 800-222-KABC. That's 800-222-5222.
We're talking to Marilyn Chinitz, who is at Blank Rome Matrimonial and Family Group. And Marilyn, you've worked on so many high net worth cases, entertainment people. And we've had other divorce attorneys on, and they talk about some of their celebrity clients and say, you know what? It's not so much different than a regular client. It just involves more money. Now, we talk about people like Tom Cruise, Michael Douglas, Wendy Williams. Is it that much different, or is it just the money that defines your practice?
Well, I think it is. very different for a lot of different reasons. And it's not just the money, because although entertainers and celebrities make an awful lot of money, those in the financial world make a very significant amount of money,
right,
far greater than the celebrities.
Mm-hmm.
But what's different is the level of privacy is gone in a celebrity divorce. So it's almost as if you don't have the right to privacy. Everything that's going on in your life gets leaked, and then it gets out there. And it also gets corrupted, because people take what's in social media, then they take a whole new story to it, adds on. And so you don't know what's true. And people's lives can be destroyed because of the lack of privacy. So I think it's a very different standard. And I think that's some of the challenges in representing celebrities and entertainers. You want to keep their lives private.
Has your practice changed a lot, given what you just said about the media and the information? I know you've been on record as saying that a lot of the information in the media is incorrect, which I think everyone seems to agree with. But it's out there. You have to contend with it. You have courts that are clogged. You have obsession with electronics. And it just seems to have made your job a lot more difficult than just simply presenting your case.
Well, I think, you know, having access to information can be a real positive, but it could be very dangerous also. And there's a lot of law that comes with the territory of what you're able to access electronically. You know, we've had cases where spouses gain access to business computers, not knowing that they're committing a felony, thinking that they're downloading all of this incredible document and incredible information. But we as lawyers know, oh, no, that's tainted goods, and we're not even touching it or looking at it. There is so much information that's available. To the extent that you can use it productively, it's great evidence. When you have matrimonial cases where a spouse is claiming he makes no money, he's not doing well, and then all of a sudden on social media, not on his social media, but on somebody else's social media, you see this individual on some big yacht with a woman providing, you know, that person is wearing all kinds of designer outfits. Once you let it out, it's out in cyberspace for everybody to see.
Right.
And people live in their own little world. They think in front of their computer, they can access and do things. But once you let it out, it's no longer yours. And so I think having the ability to access information is wonderful, especially for an attorney, but getting it the right way, getting it the legal way, the correct way, but it could be very dangerous also.
Yeah, I can see that. And, you know, it's interesting because you talk about those negative issues that come up in your practice, yet you still remain very positive and you have such widespread expertise in this area. You're writing a book about how to stay married. How ironic. Divorce attorney talking about
how
to stay married. Tell us why you're writing the book and what your perspective is, how important it is to try to stay married. I said that quote about, you know, so many people stay in their marriages. You seem to be supportive of that.
Well, I am married 35 years, going to be 36 years.
Mazel tov.
Into law. And I said, you know, I don't know how I survived it all of those years. However, now that I am in my late 60s, having spent 35 years married to the same person, I get the benefits. I see my children in a really stable environment. I have a grandchild now. We have family events.
Wow.
We just came back from a beautiful family trip in Costa Rica. And those are, to me, the real luxuries of life. And you don't give that up so quickly, at least not with a really good fight. So, yes, you know, here I am as a matrimonial lawyer. But from my experience, there were times that I wanted to freeze what my clients were telling me and say, wait a minute, are you telling me you're getting a divorce because of this reason?
Yeah.
But, of course, I can't, and I'm not their therapist. But I think there are so many wonderful things. Look, if you're in an abusive relationship, all bets are off.
Yeah.
You should never stay in that kind of relationship. But everybody is going to have bumps in the road. And I think everybody needs to learn how to navigate those bumps. because at the end, there are some very significant rewards. Kids go through so much when their parents get through a divorce. Many, many years ago, I did a workshop for children from age 5 to age 20, and it was such an eye-opener. I never did it again because it was really very heartbreaking. But when you listen to what some of the kids said and the impact that it had on them, it was so enormous that I think parents, if they got a snapshot of that, would really think twice sometimes. But, you know, people are human and they have high emotions and sometimes they can't control it. But I think people ought to learn how to control it.
You know,
how to make a marriage exciting is not an easy thing.
Right. But it's reality.
But
and, you know, I'm listening to you, Marilyn, and I swear I'm feeling chills. I'm getting chills up my body because we don't often hear people explaining like you are the joys, the values of life, the quality of life. You've seen it all, and everything you say makes so much sense. You really, you know, a couple of weeks ago, we had Jerry Springer on the show, and, you know, we talked about his show where the couples were fighting all the time and screaming at each other. Not that he believed in it, but you really need to have a show so that people can see this other side. Maybe it's not as sexy as a Jerry Springer type show for the masses, but really the quality of life and the values that you're talking about are so important. And that's why I think writing this book is so important.
Thank you. I agree with you. I mean, I think sometimes I ask people, so what did you learn about your divorce? And very often they'll say, I learned a lot about myself and how I should have handled things differently. And I think that's a very poignant statement, because they didn't learn that they made the right decision. They learned that there was a decision that was made that maybe they could have pivoted and changed the outcome. I think every relationship in life has challenges. When we go to work every day, there's nothing smooth and easy. There's always challenges.
Yeah.
But we have no choice but to navigate those challenges because we want our jobs and we want to get our money and income and so forth. So you learn how to make the best of situations.
Yep.
That doesn't mean you're compromising in life. It just means you're adapting to certain things.
Yeah.
Ultimately, people change over time. I look at my husband, who, you know, is an Italian born in Sweden, was very European. He adapted some of my qualities, and I've now adapted his qualities. Not that I speak Italian or Swedish, but you learn from one another.
You know,
and
that's
important.
You know, it's so important. Those are words of wisdom, and, you know, we've run out of time, but I would really love to have you on another time and take calls, because this positive perspective needs to get out more, especially when it involves marriage, when people give in too easily and people are too quick to say this is a reason to get divorced. And we're hearing from Marilyn Chinitz all the reasons not to get divorced. Marilyn, thank you so much for joining us on Gervie's Law today.
Thank you. So nice to be there.
All right.
Take
care.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. All right. Well, that's going to do it. Wow. What a great show. Jeffrey Kessler, Marilyn Chinitz. And this has been Gervie's Law. Thanks for listening.